Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear India's Pandit Nehru and Admiral Halsey, Sigmund Engel, Senator Taft, and the voices of President Roosevelt, Al Smith, and Fiorella LaGuardia in a special report on political campaigns. You'll hear the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now, here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
If events in a New York courtroom 48 hours ago set the pattern, you will never again hear this on your radio.
It is my privilege to present a great American and a courageous champion of peace, jobs, and security for the people of America, the communist candidate for President of the United States, Earl Browder.
That was broadcast in 1940. Now, 9 years later, October 13th, 1949, and a broadcast from the Federal District Court.
The 8 women and 4 men who now have this case in charge filed back into the jury room just a few minutes ago. There's no firm indication when the verdict will come. One of the attorneys for the defense is convinced it will not come until tomorrow.
That was how NBC reporter Leon Pearson kept us informed in the newsroom throughout the vigil. Just before noon Friday, 12 citizens pronounced judgment on 11 fellow citizens, guilty of conspiring to teach and advocate overthrow of our government. A weary federal judge, Harold Medina, added his own epilogue. Jail for the attorneys who had displayed contemptuous behavior to him. One of them was lawyer Harry Socker.
This sentence came as a great shock. It is the most devastating indication that it is later in America than we think, when American lawyers can be sent to jail for their courageous and vigorous defense of the constitutional rights of their clients.
Only yesterday, the successful prosecutor of the 11 communist leaders was nominated to a federal judgeship by the president. After the trial, federal attorney John F.X. McGoey had given this comment.
The trial here was long and tedious. In representing the government, I presented the evidence to the best of my ability to support the charge. That was my duty. The jury deliberated carefully and reached a verdict. That was its duty.
In brief, those were the simple facts of what happened at Foley Square, New York. Still to be answered is the question of, what now for the American Communist Party? Will it be outlawed? Will it go underground? Will it win by appeal its right to exist as a legitimate political party? They asked all that of Prosecutor McGoey.
Well, I prefer not to make any comment on that question.
Yes, who can say? What next for the communists of America?
As the communists in China asserted their growing influence over Asia, there came to our nation this week a spokesman for democracy in Asia.
Prime Minister Nehru of India is scholarly in his knowledge of our Western world. Yet, for this man so well-versed in our ways, this was his first visit here, and the Congress of the United States honored him by asking him to speak.
Mr. Speaker, sir, I deem it a high honor and privilege to be given this opportunity of addressing this honorable House. However the voices of India and the United States may appear to differ, there is much in common between them. Like you, we have achieved our freedom through a revolution, though our methods were different from yours. In a country of which agriculture is still the principal industry, this reform is essential not only to the well-being and contentment of the individual, but also to the stability of society.
There was much significance to the visit of this Asiatic leader at a time when the communists of China were seeking international recognition for their government. Only today they seize Canton. Many wondered when that issue of recognition would reach the United Nations, where this week the relentless, wearying East and West tug of war continued. American delegate Eleanor Roosevelt lightened things up a bit when she suggested a new term for the Soviet Iron Curtain. It happened after a ringing speech by a delegate of the Soviet Ukraine, who gave a generous picture of life inside the Soviet orbit. Mrs. Roosevelt replied in return like this.
I would only make one comment to the delegate from Ukraine. I wish so much that when he makes these very virtuous speeches, he might make it possible for us to see with our own eyes, behind the garden wall, a brick wall with a lovely garden inside, which has no gate, does not help us to follow the good example of what may be going on the other side of the brick wall. And beyond that, I have nothing more to say.
Back in the news this week, and a welcome relief from the graver matters of our time, was the case of that cantankerous old widow swindler, Sigmund Engel.
Back in the 90-degree days of last summer, we recorded the story of swindling Sam Engel and how he ran afoul of the females by bilking the ladies of their fortunes with promises to marry. Came long weeks behind bars, and then this week Sam walked out a free man on bond, and thereby hangs a rhubarb. The white-haired woo master was slam-bang in trouble again, got into a fuss with his lawyer because the lawyer's father happens to be the bondsman who got Engel sprung. And he wanted to put a bodyguard on Engel to make sure he didn't skip. And, well, anyhow, here's the confusion that resulted when NBC reporter Len O'Connor took his microphone along to watch the bond-making ceremony. The bondsman was right there when O'Connor asked Engel, "What goes on?"
"I signed an agreement with this gentleman here. An agreement which I'm ready to fulfill completely, which I'm ready to execute to the T, from A to Z. Now, after he signed my bond, after he agreed to that agreement and signed the agreement, now he comes here and surprises me that I have to be in custody of somebody while I'm free."
"What was the agreement you had with Jones?"
"The agreement was, well, perhaps he wouldn't want me to say it."
"Don't blow it apart now.
Tell it. That's all right."
"See, who the devil are you?"
"I represent the bondsman."
"You don't, I don't know you. Get out."
"I represent the bondsman, mister, and I'm going to stick to the bondsman."
"Mister, you can go and stick to the bondsman, but don't stick to me."
"Yeah, but
Sam, what was the deal? What was the agreement?"
"Who the devil are you? I don't know you.
Come on.
And I'm willing to live up to my agreement, and today he says I have to be in the custody of a man while I'm free."
Samuel Engel tossed a punch at the attorney. Then they tried to get a federal judge to revoke the bond. No dice. And for the first time in 4 months, Engel is a free man. That should be fair warning to all rich ladies who are lonesome. This is Len O'Connor in Chicago.
Admirals on parade this week as Congress continued to probe the simmering squabble over national defense strategy.
As happened last week, the Navy's Gold Braid continued to speak out against the defense emphasis on the huge B-36 bomber. And a strategy, the Navy said, which was based on the erroneous assumption that the atom bomb, delivered by air, could make short work of any war. Among those who came forward early in the week was Navy Commander Eugene Tatum. After House Armed Services Committee Chairman Vinson called the meeting to order, Commander Tatum has a statement to make that brought gasps from spectators. Here's the actual moment when it happened.
"This committee comes in order. All right, man, proceed, Commander.
Contrary to popular opinion, the effect of the atom bomb, while completely devastating in the immediate vicinity of its burst, is rather limited in the area of its destruction. You could stand in the open at one end of the north-south runway at the Washington National Airport with no more protection than the clothes you now have on, and have an atom bomb explode at the other end of the runway without serious injury to you."
"Thank you very much, Commander. Now, wait 1 minute, Mr. Bates, please. Now, wait 1 minute. We've got some very important bills on the floor. The Commander will be available for examination tomorrow if any members desire to ask me any questions. And you be back here because there's one or two questions that I'm satisfied the committee wants to get some information about, especially in view of the statement. You could stand in the open at one end of the north-south runway at the Washington Airport, no more protection than the clothes you have on, and have an atom bomb explode at the other end of the runway without serious injury to you. I'd like for you to be able to tell the committee why so many people was killed when the first one was dropped in Japan then. We'll take a recess tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock.
Well, next morning, Commander Tatum came back. He explained he was merely quoting from a government handbook on bomb effects. With that out of the way, the Vinson Committee moved on and called for a witness, the commander of the Bikini Atom Bomb Tests.
Now, Admiral, proceed. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William H.P. Blandy. I am an admiral in the United States Navy and commander-in-chief of the United States Atlantic Command and the United States Atlantic Fleet. If the Navy is being prevented from adequately discharging its current responsibilities for any reason, it is very much the people's business, and their representatives in Congress should hear of it. I feel that such harm is being done, and that there is danger of still further damage to the national defense through unwarranted reduction of the Navy's efficiency.
Following Blandy to the witness chair was another great Navy name of World War II, Bull Halsey. Representative Short took over the questioning.
Admiral Halsey, every member of this committee feels highly honored to have you present here this morning. You've attended all these hearings from the beginning up to this minute. You haven't missed anything. You believe in the supremacy of air power.
Absolutely.
And a fleet without air power, tactical air power, is really a helpless and an obsolete fleet. It's no good.
It's a sitting duck.
You believe in strategic as well as tactical bombing, do you not?
Certainly do, against the proper targets.
That's right. But you insist that any long-range bomber is almost helpless unless it's escorted by a sufficient number of fighters.
That's what my study leads me to believe, sir.
You believe that with all your heart?
I certainly do, sir.
Money for the Navy was no little part of the investigation, and Congress called on the number one Navy spokesman to hear how he felt on the question of Navy appropriations.
My name is Lloyd Enfeld. I'm an admiral in the United States Navy and chief of naval operations. As a senior military spokesman for the Navy, I want to state forthwith that I fully support the broad conclusions presented to this committee by the naval and marine officers who have preceded me. It is not so much the reduction in congressional appropriations that worries us. Our concern is with arbitrary reductions that repair or eliminate essential naval functions.
That ended it for this week, but the story is by no means over. Still to be heard from the Air Force, the Army, and what should prove a sharp exchange between Chairman Vinson and Defense Secretary Johnson.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department. The actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
The political scene noted this week a campaign begun just 1 year early. All the forces of organized labor have as their target in next year's congressional election the defeat of Ohio's Republican Senator Robert A. Taft. Off and on these past weeks, Senator Taft has been barnstorming his home state, getting a good early start as his opponents look about for a candidate to match this veteran GOP leader. NBC caught up with the traveling Taft in New Philadelphia, Ohio this week and asked him to explain why he's taken to the stump so early.
Well, I've been in Congress for 11 years, and Congress has been in almost continuous session. So I haven't had much chance to get back here except on rather a haphazard basis. And I felt it a part of the duty of a senator to go back and report to his constituents. I'm planning to go to all 88 counties in Ohio. Also, it's very important to find out what they're thinking. I think it's laying the groundwork for the campaign next year. It isn't the campaign itself.
So there we have a new wrinkle, the pre-campaign campaign. Ever stop to think how many different styles of politicking we've heard about in our nation? Today, Voices and Events goes back on the record of history to recall some of the giants of the American political scene. Hated and scorned, loved and followed were these men of more than a decade ago. The coming of Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal split the Democratic Party asunder as the Southern Conservative wing rallied around men like Senator E.D. Smith, known to all as Cotton Ed.
Mr. Toastmaster, ladies and gentlemen, this is not on my printed program, but I wish that every one of you could realize what it means today to be a real American Democrat under present conditions.
Another of this time who challenged the New Deal was one of the earliest and strongest of the state's writers. He was the all-powerful law in his own state, Louisiana, until an assassin's bullet wrote an end to the story of Huey Long.
Now you've been reading the row that's been going on between the National Administration and the state of Louisiana. Because of the fact that I am opposed to the way Mr. Roosevelt and his brain trusters and bureaucrats are running things. Louisiana does not propose to have itself put into bondage. Our people will remain free.
No, Huey Long or Cotton Ed was another who opposed Roosevelt. A man with whom a city and a song will be forever associated. No more colorful character ever came forward in American politics than this genial, humorous man from New York town. No, sir, there was no formality about Al Smith.
The gentleman in front of me with the cameras will take the pictures and disappear. There's no way I can talk to the audience with you standing in my way. I'll just pick the gesture you want. What do you want?
Yes, Al Smith. And back again in the year 1936, his rich sarcasm was directed against Franklin D. Roosevelt like this.
I was elected to office in the state of New York more times than any other living man, and I was never on any ticket but the Democratic ticket.
Listen to me for a minute. Have you followed this campaign? Have you listened on the radio? Or have you read the speeches? If you have, tell me when you heard the candidate on the Democratic ticket speak about the Democratic platform.
Never.
When did you ever hear him refer to the Democratic Party?
Never. I'll tell you what it is. It's we. And I. And the administration. And the New Deal. Why? The newspaper men were talking with the president the other day, and they asked him, what about the NRA? Did he intend to resurrect it, or was it dead forever? And he looked at them and he says, read my speeches. Let's see how these speeches run. Here's a little sample of one. I want to speak to you briefly and simply about the prosperity of all the nation. For in the prosperity, all New England has an immediate and a direct interest. Now, what is that all about? That speech was delivered in Boston. And I could boil it down into seven words by simply saying, Boston is in the United States.
Yes, to FDR, some of his own fellow Democrats, like Al Smith, were more formidable opponents than the Republicans who came forward to do battle on Election Day. But these Republicans left their mark on the fine art of campaigning. Remember Alf Landon?
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, we are entering the last week of a campaign in which the fundamental issue is preservation of the Constitution and the American way of life.
But the Landon sunflower never bloomed. Next, Wendell Willkie.
And I would also like to debate the question of the assumption by this president in seeking a third term of a greater public confidence than was accorded to our presidential giants, Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson.
Wilkie, too, went down to defeat on Election Day, and the GOP selected to do battle with the powerful incumbent in the White House, a vigorous young man whose fighting career was the talk of the nation.
This is a campaign against an administration which was conceived in defeatism, and worst of all, one which has lost faith in itself and in the American people.
But even the campaigning skill of Thomas E. Dewey proved no match for the old master. The greatest campaigner of our times didn't care to mention his opponents by name. Here's one famous moment from the campaign of 1944. The scene, a Teamsters Union dinner in Washington. The speaker, President Roosevelt.
These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me, or on my wife, or on my sons. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Talon. Well, of course, I don't resent attacks. And my family don't resent attacks. But Talon does resent it. I am accustomed to hearing malicious falsehoods about myself, such as that old worm-eaten chestnut that I have represented myself as indispensable. But I think I have a right to resent, to object to libelous statements about my dog.
History will long record the Roosevelt campaigns, and after them, the amazing story of Harry Truman and how he won the highest office in his own right. But now, let's catch up to history of the moment and the campaigns of today. Election time is coming up in New York City, and we miss the voice that kept us laughing and fuming for so long. It was a campaign worth watching when it included Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia.
Yes, I have the proof that my kind of city government is the kind of city government the people of our city want. Isn't it grand? There isn't a single solitary county chairman of either party who is in favor of my administration. To use a phrase that Al Smith liked to use in his days, I can run on a laundry ticket and beat these political bums anytime.
And he did, too. Right now, four parties are currently battling it out for New York City offices. And the American Labor Party, which put LaGuardia in City Hall, is proposing its only congressman for the office this year. The campaign of Vito Marcantonio has changed little through the years. He takes his story to the people personally through sound trucks and street meetings, like this one, when he denounces high electricity rates to a crowd on a Manhattan street corner.
Oh, I know what they're going to do. They're going to say this is communistic. This is red. This is destroying private enterprise. Well, they can call me a red 57 million times. And they can call me a red $57 million worth. But red or no red, I intend to take the $57 million and I propose to give it to the consuming public of the city of New York.
Well, if Marcantonio's campaign seems orthodox, we'll need a new term to cover what his opponents are doing. Something new has indeed been added this year. Republican and Liberal Party candidate Newbold Morris, for example, is hammering home his campaign by radio, using what we'll have to call the singing political commercial.
Friends and neighbors, this is great. Newbold Morris is a candidate. Vote for him and you'll be glad. He'll be the finest mayor we ever had. Newbold Morris is our man, and he'll do the best he can. When he's mayor, I'm confident we'll have good city government. Vote for Newbold Morris. Vote for Newbold Morris. Don't forget to make Morris mayor.
And what about William O. Dwyer? Well, he's trying for another term as a Democrat, and he's by no means outdone in this duel of the singing commercials. Yep, New Yorkers are hearing this on their radio.
O'Dwyer, 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 we want you for mayor again. O'Dwyer, 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 we'll back you to win. So remember November when election rolls around. Let's keep O'Dwyer the mayor of our town. O'Dwyer, 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 we want you for mayor again.
And over across the Hudson River, they're choosing a governor in New Jersey next month. And there, too, this new musical twist is getting a workout. Now, on the one hand, we have Republican Governor Driscoll. He prefers to answer the criticism of Democratic candidate Elmer Wien by blunt radio statements like this one, when he answered Wien's criticism of the Republican housing program.
Well, Mr. Wien's criticism is based on ignorance. That seems to be the basis for most of his statements. Suffice it to say, I expect to be back on the job at my desk the day after election and for some years to come.
But Democratic candidate Wien is another of those fanciers of the new sound in politics. And New Jersey listeners are being treated to this.
The happy mother, the father, the cop on the beat.
The candy maker, the baker, the man on the street.
The city charmer, the farmer, the man in the moon.
All swing Elmer's tune.
Yes, the swing is to Elmer Wien for governor of New Jersey.
Let's all swing Elmer's tune.
I vote for Elmer.
'Cause I like Elmer and Elmer's tune.
Yes, that's how it goes all week long and on into next week and the week after. But this business of the political singing commercial is not so new as you might think. It's been used in campaigns before, and maybe, just maybe, it had its origin in the mind of a man named George Gershwin and its birth on Broadway. Just about the beginning of this time of politics, George Gershwin brought to America the musical Of Thee I Sing, the story of a vice president named Throttlebottom, played by Victor Moore, and a fellow named William Gaxton took the part of President Wintergreen.
Wintergreen for president.
He's the man we ought to have. Wintergreen for president.
Ah, he's the man the people choose.
This has been Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history compiled by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Voices and Events returns to the air at a new time on October 30th, 2 weeks from today. Consult your newspapers for the exact time. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen again 2 weeks from today for Voices and Events. Today is Sunday, and the shows you'll hear on NBC have more luster than Blue Serge at a policeman's ball. There's Glamour of Hollywood and a whopping jackpot on Hollywood Calling. You'll hold your sides listening to Phil Harris and Alice Faye, and hold your hat in a fast caper with Sam Spade. Dorothy McGuire and Cornell Wilde team up on Theater Guild on the Air. Always remember, you're tuned for the stars on NBC.